I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, Barbara Ehrenreich on a new support group for downsized white-collar workers. But first, the Mark Foley email scandal now threatens to bring down one of the most powerful lawmakers in Washington. Speaker of the House Dennis Hastert is coming under attack by top Republicans and the conservative Washington Times newspaper for his handling of the Foley affair. Hastert has said he will not step aside for the way he dealt with inappropriate emails between former Florida Congressman Foley and a teenage page. Foley resigned Friday after an ABC News posted another set of more lurid instant messages that Foley had sent to a second page. For the latest, we turn to Chuck Babington of the Washington Post. And Chuck, let's remind ourselves, Hastert initially said he didn't know about the emails until Friday. Then other Republicans, including Tom Reynolds of New York, ahead of the Republican Campaign Committee, said they told him last spring. So what is the latest that Hastert has said when asked directly about that inconsistency?
Several of us got to sit down and ask Speaker Hastert some questions yesterday, and of course that was the first question, and he still sticks to what he has said earlier, that as far as he can recall, he didn't know anything about this until last Friday, but that he does not dispute Tom Reynolds' claim that he told him. He said, if Mr. Reynolds did tell me, then it was in the middle of a whole bunch of other things that I was preoccupied with, and it just didn't register with me.
Well, you may have asked him what Andrea Koppel of CNN asked him at that moment, which is, you know, I think that if someone had told me about concerns about a lawmaker having inappropriate email exchanges with a 16-year-old, I would have remembered it. What does he say in response to that?
What he says is that that the email that in question at that time was to the Louisiana boy, and it was an ambiguous email. It said, what do you want for your birthday? How did you survive Hurricane Katrina? And would you send me a picture of yourself? It was enough to cause the boy to be alarmed and for his parents to be concerned. But, you know, Robin, in fairness, the same email was forwarded to the FBI in July, and we now know, as we reported in today's paper, that the FBI did not consider that to be enough to launch an investigation. So that's what Speaker Hastert is saying, is that a reasonable person could draw the conclusion that this just isn't enough to go on.
And so he forgot about it. But you did write today about the FBI not launching an investigation after learning about these same emails last July. Why are they saying they didn't?
They're just saying kind of the same thing, that it was too ambiguous, that there could be a, you know, I mean, they're not saying a lot, don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. They're just saying it did not, you know, rise to the level of information that would prompt an investigation.
Well, apparently it concerned GOP leaders who learned of the emails in 2005, I think, and dealt with them privately, actually, I think at the request of the family, too, also wanted it to be handled privately.
The family did want it to be quiet. They did want Foley to stop contacting the boy, and you're right. What it got kind of passed up the line from the Louisiana congressman, Mr. Alexander, and he's the one that told Tom Reynolds, and then at some point, either the speaker was or was not told. Mm-hmm. Both Reynolds and Majority Leader Boehner said they believe they did tell him. But from there, Robin, it was really kept quiet. And I think the Republicans are deeply, deeply regretting this now, because they chose to keep it sort of in the family, if you will. And only a couple of Republican officials spoke with Foley. He told them it was innocent, there's nothing wrong. And they said, all right, well, just don't contact the page anymore. And now they very much wish that they had brought even one Democrat into that room, because then of course, from a political standpoint, they'd be able to say, hey, the Democrats knew, and they didn't do anything either.
And the Democrat and another Republican on the Page Committee are been pretty vocal about how angry they are that they were kept in the dark. But as you said, some GOP leaders were concerned enough to approach Foley and tell him to cut off contact. Now the Washington Times has asked Dennis Hastert to resign as Speaker. He says he won't. First of all, how, you know, whether or not he steps down as Speaker of the House, how will that reflect his own race to hang on to his seat?
You know, I'm not an expert on Illinois politics. I'd be very surprised if he has trouble holding on to his own seat. You know, the vast, vast majority of House members are just safe, largely because of gerrymandering and all that both parties do. I haven't heard anybody suggest that. I do think the bigger problem is, can he hang on to his leadership position? And mm-hmm. perhaps he can, but the real problem he's got is that not only is the public up in arms, but his top lieutenants, Mr. Reynolds, the chairman of the campaign committee, and Mr. Boehner, the majority leader, are both at odds with him on this and saying, hey, you know, we told him and we're not going to take the blame for it. So that's a real problem when he's got his very top, lieutenants not really on his team at this point.
But how high does it go? What about the White House? Yesterday, spokesperson Tony Snow referred to the emails dismissively early on, saying they were, naughty notes. He came back later and refined the language somewhat. I think he called them horrific. But it seemed as if early on, at least, through Tony Snow, the White House was sending a message this wasn't as important. Do we have any sense of where they weigh in on what Hastert should do?
Well, I don't know what advice they might be giving Hastert. There's no way. Obviously, there's no connection that anybody knows of between the emails directly and the White House or the administration. But obviously, the problem is to the Republican Party, and that's why one reason they sent Tony Snow out to help do damage control yesterday. And in the beginning, he did not get off to a good start. And as you noted, he had to sort of recover later in the day. But coming on top of the problems in Iraq and the NIE and estimate and the Bob Woodward book. It's a bad week, or turning into 2 weeks for the whole Republican Party, including the White House, and of course you've got the November 7 election coming up.
Chuck Babington of the Washington Post. All eyes are on that. Chuck, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, how is the Foley scandal affecting lawmakers on the campaign trail headed toward November? Democrats are within striking distance of taking control of the House of Representatives. They need to hold on to all of their current seats and win 15 more to get a majority in the House. And now, in addition to Foley's seat in Florida, Democrats suddenly find themselves eyeing Republican Representative Tom Reynolds in New York. As we said, Reynolds was one of the lawmakers who learned last spring that Foley had sent the so-called overly friendly emails to a page. And Reynolds claims to have passed that information on to Speaker Hastert. As we just heard, Hastert says he doesn't remember. Joining us with more on the Reynolds race is Jim Campbell, political scientist at the University of Buffalo, State University of New York. And Jim, Congressional Quarterly has now downgraded Reynolds' chances of winning re-election. He seemed to be, prior to this past week, a shoo-in.
Right. I mean, a lot of the experts indicated that they thought this was going to be a safe Republican district. I think there were they probably had overestimated that from the beginning. In the last election, Reynolds' opponent, Jack Davis, who was independently wealthy, spent a lot of money and made it a fairly close race 2 years ago. I think it turned out 56-44, and they're spending even more money on both sides now.
Well, Democrats in your area apparently seem to smell blood in the water. They've said they're going to start to run commercials. Because they say that Mark Foley gave $100,000 to the committee that Reynolds chairs, the National Republican Campaign Committee, in fact, just before these emails were released last spring. And they want Reynolds to give up that $100,000.
Right. I think this indicates where the Democrats can easily overplay their hand here. They issued a press release the other day that said Reynolds' group received $100,000 from Pedophile while he was covering for him. Now, that's is extreme based on what we know the facts to be at this point. So.
Well, the Buffalo News reports that Laura Bush is going to come to a fundraiser for Reynolds tomorrow. This was planned before the scandal broke. But some are seeing that as a sign that he's in trouble and has asked for the best life preserver that the White House can throw.
Well, I think you're right that this was planned well in advance. And this was going to be a race that couldn't be taken for granted from either side, several weeks ago before any of this hit. Jack Davis has been campaigning very aggressively, mostly on a free trade or opposition to free trade and a jobs platform. And Reynolds has been countering that Davis's position amounts to big tax increases on middle-class families. So this has been a tighter race than I think the national experts had given it credit for.
Jim Campbell, political scientist at University at Buffalo, State University of New York. Professor Campbell, thank you.
Glad to be on the show.
Well, on either side of the aisle, if some politicians lose their jobs in November, they will join a crowd. The number of planned job cuts in the U.S. last month topped 100,000, up more than 50% from August. And if anyone needed proof that a college degree does not insulate you from the pressures of a global economy, September's layoff announcements included the 14,000 white-collar jobs cut by Ford Motor Company, and the 750 jobs that Marsh & McLennan, the world's largest insurance broker, plans to eliminate, bringing to 6,000 the number of white-collar jobs lost at the firm in the last 2 years. We want to spend a few minutes today talking about the white-collar labor force with Barbara Ehrenreich, author of Nickel and Dime. Now, previously, she'd focused her attention on the plight of waitresses and workers at Walmart, the service industry. In her latest book, Bait and Switch, she switches to professionals, and she's just launched something called United Professionals. She joins us now on the line from New York. Barbara, welcome.
Hi, good to be with you.
And first of all, tell us, what exactly is United Professionals? Is it a union?
No, no. A union wouldn't make any sense because we're talking about people who are in many different occupations, in fact, changing occupations, who may be employed, may not be employed. We define our constituency as the unemployed, underemployed, and anxiously employed white-collar workers.
And who
That's
do
a
you,
lot of people.
It is, yeah, more and more lately, but who do you define as white-collar workers?
Well, you see, this is actually a very broad group because we would include people who, you know, had white-collar jobs but now have, because of layoffs, have ended up in a blue-collar workforce. But basically, we're reaching out to those people who are college-educated, you know, who bought the idea, as most of us did, probably you too, you know, that if you have a college degree and you work hard and you conform to certain rules, you are going to be pretty much all right.
And,
but that's not what we're finding.
And how, you know, what is the catalyst for this? I mean, obviously, in researching Bait and Switch, those who have read it know you were trying to get a white-collar job and didn't succeed?
Well, it even goes back further than that. After I wrote Nickel and Dimed, I got a lot of mail from people in experiencing real hardship, low-wage workers, but who told me that they had college degrees, even master's degrees, and had once had decent-paying jobs until that downsizing or riffing or whatever came along. And that's what intrigued me. So that's why I went undercover for Bait and Switch as a white-collar job seeker, to sort of immerse myself in that world.
As you'd gone undercover as a waitress, let's say, in Nickel and Dime, but what did you find? What were some of the things that propelled you?
Well, I found that it's not that easy to get a job. I was pretty cocky to begin with. You know, I thought, this can't, you know, I can do this. I'm claiming to be a PR person. I can write, I can talk, you know, I'm presentable, or so I thought. So I found it was very hard, but I also found myself among people who were really feeling kind of beaten after 6 months, 1 year, 2 years of looking for jobs, and who wanted to come together, wanted to be together in some way, were happy to be in these networking groups that I was frequenting often, but when they would get to these groups, they would often be exploited or proselytized or, you know, some kind of religious grouping. But it was not for them, really. There was not something that really reflected their needs and their experiences.
That's Barbara Ehrenreich, author of Nickel and Dimed and now Bait and Switch, and now has just launched something called United Professionals to answer the needs of these white-collar workers who'd been either laid off or downsized that she met while going undercover to research the white-collar world. I suppose the new bumper sticker, White-Collar Workers of the World Unite. And when we come back, we'll ask Barbara Ehrenreich exactly how this group works. We know its mission is to have 25 chapters nationally. We'll find out more about how it'll work, how it'll affect health care, severance pay, wages. Much more with Barbara Ehrenreich when we come back. You're listening to Here and Now. Robin Young, it's Here and Now. We're back with author Barbara Ehrenreich. As we said, she worked as a waitress and at Walmart to write her book Nickel and Dimed, and now she's looking at the world of white-collar workers in the book Bait and Switch, and in a new proposal, a new organization called United Professionals, a nonprofit organization to help white-collar workers deal with the uncertainty of working in the era of outsourcing and restructuring. And Barbara, exactly what would the group do? We mentioned before the break that you look to have 25 chapters. What will they do?
Well, actually, we've already had volunteers spring up in 100 cities who want to create chapters. If they're serious, that's a lot of cities.
It is.
Yeah, so we have, three three things on our agenda. One is just a way for people to come together where there's not some kind of snake oil state salesman at the front of the room telling you, you know, that it's all your attitude and you everything will be all right.
Right. You do write that there's a lot of organizations springing up to counsel white-collar workers, but there's usually a sales pitch and one that doesn't help them.
Yeah, it's often a big victim-blaming line that you get them to. That it's really all in you, you know, whether if you take personal responsibility, if you have the right attitude, you'll be okay. So there would be none of that. I'd like people to be able to share stories, share tips, be able to get together on their own terms. Secondly, we're going to do advocacy. We want to be able to represent the economic issues of a lot of people here who don't generally get together and speak for themselves.
Be more like AARP in that way.
Yeah, that would be an example. So we're, you know, some of the kinds of issues are health insurance. We need universal health insurance because, you know, your job is not attached to you anymore.
Right.
And, by the way, this is a big problem, not just for the person over 50 or over 40 who's laid off, but for the struggling 20-something who comes out of college with, you know, an average of $20,000 in debt and can't get any traction in the workforce and doesn't have health insurance. Another kind of advocacy issue is unemployment insurance, which is right now so inadequate that it covers only about one-third of people who lose their jobs through layoffs.
Well, let's stop with insurance there for a second because we've read a lot of comments posted on The Nation's website. This was in response to a piece about you and United Professionals. And as you well know, a lot of Americans now think universal health care means a step towards socialism. And there's some anti-union sentiment out there, a feeling that unions have failed, watching the car industry and watching many in the car industry blame the unions for the high cost of health care. And now you're proposing, you know, moving that, you know, same thinking of providing health care to white-collar workers. So how do you fight against that perception that that hasn't worked in unions?
Well, certainly what we have now by way of health insurance doesn't work at all. The idea of having it attached to your job may have made more sense when people had two or three jobs in a lifetime. But that's not the situation anymore. Employer-based health insurance makes no sense. Now, whether it's run by the government, federal government, run by the states, run by some quasi-public body, I don't know. I leave that for others to figure out. But we've got to have health insurance that's attached to the person, not the job. As I said, we're not a union. We're kind of an association, more on the model of the AARP.
Right. And staying with unions, I mean, we understand that their membership is at an all-time low. And so are you feeling something different? Are you feeling that people are in the mood to join something?
I think there's a big need here. Whether white-collar people who are traditionally rather individualistic will, you know, come together in some form, and it's, you know, a lot of it's coming together on the Internet, which is pretty easy, remains to be seen. The initial response to United Professionals has been a little overwhelming for us, though.
You mean so much response?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we're just struggling to keep up right now.
What would you do about the concern about wages? I mean, we know that earnings for workers with bachelor's degrees fell 5.2% between 2000 and 2004, while production in many cases has gone up. You know, so like blue-collar workers, white-collar workers are working more, making more product, but they're making less money. You know, some are saying this is just it, the new global reality, but do you think your organization can do anything about wages?
I think so. I mean, one thing I would like this new organization to stand for is the principle of a living wage for anybody who works. You know, that's a simple idea. But I think, you know, what you've talked about, this declining wage gap between the college-educated and the blue-collar working class is kind of important because we're trying to address the reality that maybe at one time white-collar people were automatically on this higher level. You know, saw themselves and a status very much removed from the working class, so-called. Mm-hmm. That's not so true anymore. The big change is that white-collar people are just as disposable from the employer's point of view as blue-collar people.
What do you do about the perception, though? And it's funny that leads to this thought we were going to ask you. The perception that white-collar workers are also, you know, management in many cases, and they're the ones who've cut the blue-collar jobs. And so there's not a lot of sympathy for them now.
Yeah, I think they, but remember, they're not just managers.
Right, but they include managers.
Yeah, they include them, and maybe those won't be the first people to rush to join up with us, but they're also, I think they're more commonly people like yourself, Robin, or like me, you know, who have a college degree and are making a living one way or another. People who are IT workers, software writers, marketing people, that those are the people who are typically called professionals as opposed to managers.
And also often feel like they're hanging onto their jobs by their nails, perhaps. Barbara Ironwright, just one last thought about how this works real quick, sort of the lightning round. Will there be dues?
There are dues, but they're not expensive. It's a dime a day, $36.50 a year. You can go to unitedprofessionals.org and sign up. You know, everybody has been saying the middle class is under attack. Well, here's your chance to fight back.
And how would they do that? Just in the few seconds we have left, is there are they required to participate?
You just go to the website and start there.
Barbara Ironwright, author of Nickel and Dimed and Bait and Switch, and just launched something called United Professionals, which you can participate in by going to our website, here-now.org, to find out more about. Barbara, thanks as always.
Oh, my pleasure.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Two more girls shot in an Amish schoolhouse in Pennsylvania yesterday have died of their wounds. And more is becoming known about the man who killed them, 32-year-old Charles Carl Roberts, a milk truck driver who lived up the road from the schoolhouse. The Pennsylvania police commissioner says Roberts told his wife that he molested underage family members 20 years ago. This story is unfolding as the Pennsylvania legislature takes up previously scheduled debate about gun control legislation today. On the line with us now is Scott Gilbert, news director for NPR station WITF in Harrisburg. And Scott, to the shooting first, Pennsylvania police held another news conference today. What did they say about this unexplained grudge from 20 years ago that Roberts allegedly told his wife motivated him to go to this school in the first place?
Well, we apparently know a lot more today than we did yesterday about this grudge that police just simply alluded to, that event that happened 20 years ago, which would have been when the shooter, Charles Carl Roberts, was approximately 12 years old. He left a note for his wife saying that, you know, he loved the good times they had together, but lamenting the tragedy of losing their daughter about 9 years ago. She lived just 20 minutes, and how that had changed his life forever, and how that had fueled a hatred toward himself and a hatred he had for God as a result of that event. But it wasn't until he was on the phone with his wife just moments before the shootings were carried out that he told her about alleged molestations that happened approximately 20 years ago. He said that he had molested two family members who were between the ages of 3 and 5, and that he had been having dreams lately about carrying out such an act again, and that he was unable to control the impulse to want to do that again and to act upon those dreams he had been having.
Have the police said that there were any police reports at the time of that kind of molestation or any other evidence of it?
Colonel Miller of the Pennsylvania State Police says that there is no documentation at this point that they've tracked down, or even any knowledge within the family among his wife or other family members that these molestations had happened. So at this point, police have nothing to go on other than what Roberts has told them about these alleged molestations taking place.
Scott Gilbert, we just have a few seconds. Do I understand that the Amish family members whose children might have been in that school plan to go commiserate with the family of Mr. Roberts?
I haven't heard much about that. I do know that there is a prayer vigil set for later on today in the community, and that's going to bring together both Amish and non-Amish members of the community. That's going to be happening later on today there near where the shootings happened.
Scott Gilbert, news director for NPR station WITF in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Scott, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, another question being raised. Does this shooting in Pennsylvania, coupled with last week's hostage-taking and shooting in a Colorado school, signal a new trend in school violence. We turn now to noted criminologist James Fox. He's a professor at Northeastern University here in Boston. Professor Fox, we want to ask you for your thoughts on the shooting. This is the third deadly school incident in a week. There was a principal killed in Wisconsin as well. But first, a few questions about gun control, because it is being debated in Pennsylvania. The mayor of Philadelphia says his city has more than twice the number of guns as New York, 31,000 compared to 15,000. But there's this tug in Pennsylvania between urban gun control advocates and the rest of the state where guns are used by hunters. Your thoughts on that conflict?
Well, urban areas have very different crime problems than rural areas. They're basically two different worlds. And it is hard to resolve the concerns of urban dwellers and rural residents who want to go hunting.
But
to use a case like this, the school shooting, as a vehicle for pushing legislation doesn't make a lot of sense. We had major school shootings in Scotland and Great Britain, in places where they have much stricter gun legislation than we do now. Yet, on the other hand, I heard read in the blogosphere yesterday some of the NRA proponents saying, all we need to do is punish these guys, it'll deter them. Obviously, Mr. Roberts yesterday would not have been deterred by any punishment since he was planning to take his own life.
Right. And you've written that to the urban gun problem, legislators need to go after rogue gun dealers to eradicate that problem.
Yeah, that's essentially an issue of the distribution stream and the marketing of guns, where it's very easy to go into certain dealers and basically make illegal purchases. And we know which dealers they are. They're over half the guns that are used in crime can be traced to fewer than 1% of the dealers.
Mm-hmm. Now, we understand that in Pennsylvania, as in most states, a permit isn't required to buy a handgun. Guns don't have to be registered. Police are saying that Mr. Roberts acquired his guns legally and over a lengthier period of time, so nobody could detect. He didn't seem to be stockpiling. But what is your overall concern about how laws might be changed to better protect people?
Well, let me say first about Mr. Roberts. Like most mass murderers, they buy their guns legally. They don't see themselves as criminals. They see themselves as law-abiding citizens who are only looking for some justice. But as far as what measures, these are some of the tragedies that happen in a society that has freedoms that we treasure. It's important that we not think in epidemic terms. When you look at the risks, despite the tragedies and that happened yesterday and last week, every year about 24 school children are murdered at school. When you consider the fact that there are over 50 million school children, the chances are literally 1 in 2 million, about the same chances being killed by lightning.
I've also read you've written that you feel that guns should be registered.
Yes, I do. Cars are registered, guns should be registered.
But would that have affected yesterday's shooting?
No. But I'm saying is that not much would have affected yesterday's shooting. And I know we want to protect our children, and we should. But you know what we should do first is have a law for bicycle helmets, because 400 kids every year die in bicycle accidents. So,
yeah, but as you know, that doesn't calm the fears of parents now who think that there may be a new trend. And I want to ask you, you know, you seem to be saying that you don't think there's one. And just to remind people, on Friday, a student shot and killed his school principal in Wisconsin. But 2 days before that, an older man isolated some girls and shot and killed one at a school in Colorado. Now, we've seen adult-on-adult violence in the workplace, student-on-student and teacher violence in schools. But people are now saying, wait a minute, is this a new category? Angry adults on students.
No, actually, in the 1988 and 89 there were nine separate episodes of adults who went on to school into school areas and buildings and schoolyards with guns, shooting students.
So, do you think? Are you an analyst who thinks that there is such a thing as copycat killings? And do you think this may be at least a spasm of that?
Sure, there's copycat effects, but that doesn't mean that the publicity makes people who are perfectly content with their lives turn into madmen. What copycatting generally does is to pattern a crime. That is, Mr. Roberts had his grudge and issues for a long period of time, and likely he would have eventually resolved it in some way, violent way, whether he would have done it in a school or not, that's debatable. But still, he would have likely had some outburst somewhere at some time.
Dr. James Fox, a professor of criminal justice at Northeastern University here in the Boston area. Well, still to come. Forget Hollywood. What's it really like to be a little person? A dwarf makes a definitive documentary. That's still coming up. You're listening to Here and Now. It's time to take a moment to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts. Last week, we spoke with Republican State Representative Adam Hastner of Florida. Now, he wants that state to end its contract giving Venezuela's state-owned Citgo company exclusive rights at Florida Turnpike rest stops because of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez's comments about President Bush. Chavez called Bush the devil and an alcoholic, and Hastner says those comments were destabilizing to the U.S. Willie Bryce of Naples, Florida, disagrees. Can we please stop this political immaturity, Willie writes? As with our country, not all Venezuelans agree with their president, and Chavez's offensive comments have very little impact on us. Our government should grow up. Paul Whiting of Billings, Montana, adds, I was disappointed not to hear how our administration supported a coup against President Chavez. Now that's destabilization. Well, we also spoke recently with Kathleen Carroll, editor for the Associated Press, about an Iraqi AP photographer who was picked up and detained by U.S. authorities. Kathleen said the AP wanted the U.S. to either charge the photographer or let him go, but she also said the Associated Press was sure their Iraqi employees were not insurgents. John Lutz of Hamilton, Massachusetts, called to ask, how can you be so sure?
The lady said they know if they're clean or not. Turns out that the Time bureau chief was a communist spy in the late 60s, early 70s.
John is referring to Pham Swan Anh, Time magazine bureau chief in Saigon during the Vietnam War, and it was later revealed a spy for the Viet Cong. Pham Swan Anh died last month at the age of 79. Well, we always welcome the occasional correction on pronunciation, and this one came about a word that often pops up in the news.
I'm a devoted listener with a good-natured, well-intended correction. It's anti-Semitic, not Semitic. It's spelled with an I, not with an E.
Duly noted. The most response last week came after our look at former President Bill Clinton's heated exchange with Fox News anchor Chris Wallace. At one point, the former president telling Wallace he had a smirk on his face. Eric Rolnick of Conway, New Hampshire writes, you seemed to think that Bill Clinton's remark about Chris Wallace having a smirk on his face was not presidential or proper. But if Wallace was smirking, I find that disrespectful and unprofessional. On the other hand, Johannes Knessel of Winston-Salem, North Carolina, thought we were way too easy on Clinton. He writes, Clinton said that he had tried to kill Osama bin Laden and that he had, in fact, contracted to have him killed. Isn't the issue of whether this kind of assassination is legal and how the use of this terminology reflects on the honor of the presidency the real story here? At least Mr. Bush would use terms like bring to justice. But Mark Catalano of Amagansett, New York, represented many of you when he wrote, describing Clinton as lashing out and questioning whether he was presidential was in line with the conservative smear which is appearing in their outlets as Clinton gone nuts, when in fact he was standing up with passion, conviction, and with actual facts, no less, to a bullying, disinforming propaganda organ of the administration, Fox News, something few have been able to do successfully. Well, finally, our interview with 92-year-old dance great Frederick Franklin, who danced with the fabled Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, brought back memories of that company for Marilyn Bentoff of Newton, Massachusetts.
I went to see it on my 16th birthday in 1946. I had never seen ballet before. I had never seen any live dance troupe before. Having lived in the immigrant community where we didn't usually get such exposure to that kind of culture. And I will never forget it. I walked out of there with stars in my eyes, and so I was thrilled to hear this wonderful 92-year-old man speaking.
I've always loved what I've done, and I've had a talent, and I've stretched it and used it and done everything I can with it. And it's an awful thing to say, but I'm very grateful from whoever gave it to me, because that's what it's all about.
As always, we'd love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters at here-now.org. Or give a call, leave a message at 617-358-0397. 617-358-0397. Please remember to include your full name, your phone number, and town. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Little people have a spotty relationship with the movies. Think The Wizard of Oz, Fellini, Herzog movies, and just about every nightmare sequence, Chucky, the Oompa Loompas. Little people have been a visual cue for the bizarre. Well, now 40-something Stephen Delano has decided to take the reins from Hollywood and make his own documentary about little people. And this man, who says he doesn't like to see his own reflection in a window, puts himself center stage. The film is called No Bigger Than a Minute.
Step up, get your ticket. Alive and inside, a full-grown human being, only 29 inches tall. She speaks, breathes, and feeds just like everybody else. Like General Tom Thumb, this pint-sized princess is no bigger than a minute.
No Bigger Than a Minute, a Midwestern colloquialism perhaps attributed to P.T. Barnum when he was exhibiting Tom Thumb. The film airs tonight on PBS's POV series, and director Steve Delano joins us from the studios of KUVO in Denver, Colorado, with more. Welcome.
Thank you for inviting me here.
Well, you've put together so many images. Let's take a listen to how Hollywood has treated dwarfs over time. Let's listen.
Ladies and gentlemen and children of all ages, we're going to present for your approval a novelty picture with an all-midget cast, the first of its kind ever to be produced. And it's called The Terror of Tiny Town. But I must caution you not to take it too seriously.
All the wild men, big cigars, gigantic girls, they're all laughing at me now.
No thanks. Bad luck. Three on a midget.
So often you.
So many things were set in motion for me that day. As if a curtain opened and something was revealed. A brief glimpse of the mystery of how a physical difference can mark a person for life. Me? I'm still looking for clues.
Well, even though you didn't like your own reflection, at one point in the movie you say, look at me, head on shoulders like some Pez dispenser.
Yeah, I really feel that way. That's the way I look.
Is it true, too, and this is the sense I got from the film, but is it true that you also, even after all these years, hadn't really thought about this, had looked away from that reflection in the window?
That's exactly true. I pretended that, I wasn't there, pretended that I was not so visibly and physically different from everyone else. And that plays into why it was so difficult to actually, put myself in front of the camera.
As you say, you spent most of your life pretending not to notice people, pretending not to notice you.
Yeah. It's often that you catch someone, doing their double take, and then you want to let them off the hook and pretend that you didn't notice.
Well, we have a scene, in fact, where a man, he holds you hostage on the street because he wants to talk to you. Let's listen.
Hey, excuse me. I ask you, do you mind sitting?
No, I'll sit with you for 2 minutes.
Hey, guess what? I just need a half.
Okay.
Now, guess what? First of all, you got it on?
I've had people kiss me in bars. I've had people kiss me on a shuttle bus. I've had people want to pick me up, who want to hold me. And it goes on from there.
You don't like me? That's on you. Did I disrespect you?
No.
I called you what?
Man.
Stephen Delano, what's happening when people come up and they, sometimes it's with real compassion and curiosity and wanting to get to know you.
That is entirely true. And that's the fun flip side of it. I think I've benefited from all of this attention because I get more human interaction than the average Joe. And, while we're on this planet, I think that's probably a good thing.
On the other hand, we rush to point out there are times when it's not. Did a woman really physically attack you on a
at South Station?
Here in Boston?
In Boston, yeah. She menaced me, and she was screaming Chucky. So I think she thought that I resembled that horror movie puppet. But indeed, she wanted me to clear her space, and she came at me and she kicked me in the shins, screaming Chucky, Chucky, get away, Chucky. It was odd,
to say the least. It sounds like you get a lot of your sense of yourself from your family. You grew up right around here in New Bedford, Massachusetts, an Irish-Polish Catholic family. And New Bedford's a sort of a working-class immigrant town right on the waterfront on the New England. It couldn't be more New England.
No. It's a good, strong family. They love me. I love them. And I can't say anything. I can't say more about them. They just made me who I am today.
You interview your mom. Your dad's deceased, but you interview your mom in the film, and you ask her some really pointed questions. Obviously, it sounds like questions you just hadn't thought to ask her before. For instance, would she have aborted you had she known you would have dwarfism? What was that like, asking that question?
Well, it had to be asked. And it was a really, really good conversation that we had. It just so happened that there was a film crew there. So, I felt that I needed to challenge her a little bit, and she dealt with it quite well.
She said no, flatly. She would not have chosen an abortion.
Yeah, she says no, not at all.
Wouldn't it occur to her? We also talk about this question in light of this new frontier of genetic engineering that we now live with. What would happen if dwarfism is bred out of human beings if we have the choice to do that?
I'm trying to answer this question in a somewhat indirect way in the film, in No Bigger Than a Minute. What would the world be missing if there were no dwarfs? And, it's not for nothing that, dwarfs have often been entertainers and, court jesters, but I'll speak about other people. I think that there's a certain wisdom a dwarf or a person with a disability develops to survive, but also just because they're on the outside, and I don't think that it's a good idea to out of hand try to eliminate all the physical differences that dwarfism is an example of.
And yet, as you point out, you didn't meet another dwarf until you were 35, and we see you. A large part of the film is you attend a Little People of America conference. Hundreds of people who have gathered together and formed this community. And you, at least early on, you seemed, hesitant to sort of identify with that community. It's an ambivalence that a lot of the people you talk to seem to have, initially at least, because you talk to a number of well-known dwarfs. Peter Dinklage, the actor who stars in The Station Agent, Meredith Eaton, another actress from Family Law, and I think I just saw an ad for her for Boston Common, the TV show, the rapper Bushwick. And they seem to have that same sort of pride in the population they're a member of, but also not wanting to all be brushed with the same brush.
You're right. You're describing a common experience. And if what we have to think about is that was then, and this is now. Things have changed, and I think it's unrealistic or not helpful to not acknowledge that LPA has so much to offer. And so families, are learning about the existence of the organization when we knew nothing about them when I was a kid. And, recognizing that the medical resources and the educational resources and the social resources that, are there to benefit them.
Filmmaker Stephen Delano, his documentary is called No Bigger Than a Minute. It airs tonight on POV. For local listings, go to our website, here-now.org. Steve, thanks so much for talking to us.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.